So, Horace, you've been talking about cars from time to time. I just bought a new car, so tell me what's happening in your
Well,
observations of the car business.
cars are a great subject. I think I mentioned this on the critical path because I think it's one of these industries that everybody knows and everybody has an opinion on. It's been around for 100 years, so we have a lot of data. It's a huge driver of economic activity, especially in developed countries. I read some statistics from an association of sort of automobile manufacturers, which claims like 1 in 5 jobs is due to the car industry, or something to that effect. There's some huge number about the value of the business, but and politically, it's very important because apparently large car companies are not allowed to fail. So
Right.
that means somebody's got an in on a politician somewhere. But at the same time, though, it's diverse because you do have, well, it is and it isn't. You have many countries who produce cars, and you have many companies that produce cars, and there is turnover in terms of who's making money selling cars or building cars. But it is also weirdly consistent in many ways and across the world. There was a time when there was a lot of difference between countries. There was a time when cars were differentiable or differentiated by the country they were built in. That I think is going away. It's sort of become far more the delta has come down. So the worst performers have gotten worse, performers have gotten better, and the best performers have gotten worse to some degree because they've tried to become bigger and had to compromise. And then at the same time, we have entrants in the form of emerging markets, like mainly, I think, Korea in the last few decades. We've had Eastern European manufacturing going on, although not of new brands. We've had brands in Europe consolidate through ownership, through purchase, through acquisition, and some interesting developments. I mean, Volkswagen, for example, is becoming a spectacular success in ways that are not so visible.
Right. They're almost the largest now in the world, and very vertically integrated, which is unusual.
Exactly. It's more about the fact that they're successful with innovation on the business model side rather than on the car, on the product side. So there's a lot of moving parts, a lot of things you can look at, and there's of course the thing I've been obsessed about though is that we've had this notion of focus on the product. Product has been the thing that we analyze as far as the industry's success or failure. So we tend to think about whether cars are getting bigger, whether cars are getting more fuel efficient, whether cars are improving in one or another dimension, or regressing on some dimension. And so we discuss the health of the industry in terms of the product. And that's, I think, actually becoming less interesting once the product is very difficult to differentiate between companies. This is why I would say start thinking more about the innovation, not on the product side, but rather on this business model and innovation, as we mentioned, Volkswagen becoming more integrated. Toyota came in, and Toyota, we don't really talk about Toyota cars. I mean, the Toyota innovation has been for decades around their production
Production
system,
system, right?
right? So even in the 1950s, it wasn't really that General Motors had was the object of admiration for its cars. It was an object of admiration for its branding, its
And
marketing, the way it
organization,
was,
yeah.
organization structure, the way it was able to run the ship.
Mm-hmm.
It was that became the thing that made GM rather than product. Product, there was, you know, I read a great book on it was not on the car industry, it was actually on the manufacturing World War II. And the thing was that, it's a great book, Freedom's Forge, I think it's called.
Right.
And I mentioned it before, but the amazing story is how actually the auto industry was the blueprint for manufacturing almost everything during the war. And the people out of Detroit who became the executives that were hired to solve the production problems for the whole of the U.S., they came out of Detroit, or the school of thought, the school of production. And it wasn't just in the U.S. The Soviet Union picked up almost all the tricks, and in fact a lot of the tooling from the U.S. In the 1930s. They were able to purchase a lot of spare capacity that was going idle in the U.S. in the form of machine tools, and so a lot of Stalin's factories were tooled by American, American manufactured tooling. Same thing with Nazi Germany. They were enthralled with the Ford production system at the time, and right. and borrowed huge amounts of U.S. sort of IP in that sense, in making Germany run on a production system that was mass production. And later, actually after the war, it was Japan that was actually built on those principles as well. So it's to me, the fascination with automobiles goes beyond the product. It goes into this whole question of how are cars produced, how are cars marketed, how does a country industrialize even on the basis of this production method. So much learning. I'm just now skimming yet another book on also an aircraft production in World War II, and no scholar of the history of World War II can ignore the auto industry. Even the writers of this book point out how the engines that went into airplanes, for example, although there were some manufacturers of specifically of aero engines, a lot of even in the 1920s and 30s, a lot of the knowledge about engines came from the auto industry, and there were auto manufacturers who were shipping engines to the aircraft industry. But the book points out how the economic value of the car industry during the 20s and 30s was orders of magnitude higher than the aircraft industry. The aircraft industry was producing, in some terms of GDP or in terms of output, less than 1% of the value of the car industry. See, this was true in the 20s and 30s. It was an amazing industry back then. So anyway, long story, but that's one of the things that I'm curious about is how cars have... where do they go from here? Because we've gotten to a lot of interesting junctions in the road, if you will. One is...
Well, right. I think you're getting to a great point, which is like other industries you've looked at where the value proposition is changing. I mean, I looked at some data this weekend that at least 26% of Americans from 14 to 34 don't have a driver's license now. And in Japan, it's significantly higher than that.
And well, we also have this growing in Europe too.
Yeah, this growing urbanization, and then of course car sharing services and all these other things. So you're right that the value proposition is certainly beginning to change, and one wonders where that'll lead us in the next 5 years.
Yeah. So what's happening? Usually disruptions come from places you don't expect them, right? So it happens when the product isn't really, like I said, the product, the obsession on the product side, it becomes suddenly you're looking at something you didn't realize that it was a product, because the job is what's being solved by the new thing, and it isn't necessarily something on four wheels.
A V8 engine or
diesel
engine. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So people are right now, so one thing I have issues with is the Tesla thing. I think the Tesla product is And I'm not the only one. I mean, Tesla's been around for a while. And when Tesla launched, they launched with a Roadster that was $100,000 or something.
Lotus,
like.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it was based on the Lotus chassis. I think their prototype was even based on the Ariel Atom, so predating that even. So there was an English chassis as well. And then they went to Lotus. And then, of course, the problem was that it was very expensive. And so when Elon Musk was asked about this, he said, well, all technologies begin with early adopters who are usually wealthier and are willing to pay for the innovation at the beginning. And so his point of view is very much the opposite of a disruptor's point of view. The idea of behind, even though people talk about this, you know, the Tesla disrupting, it isn't disrupting in the classic sense. Now, let me put some caveats. One, it may be that it is disruptive in terms of distribution. It may be that the idea of getting rid of dealers is a disruptive idea, which allows them to evolve the product. Maybe the service aspect will be disruptive, because then if you hire the car as transportation, but you don't have to deal with sales, service, support, and all these other issues, because they take that away and they make the car a service, then there might be opportunity there to redefine the value proposition. But fundamentally, the idea of changing the way everybody drives and the way transportation is handled isn't going to come from a powertrain change. There are in fact issues with this particular powertrain running headlong into obstacles. Not only do we have problems with filling stations, problems with range anxiety, problems with weather and applicability in all types of driving everywhere. They built these cars to solve too many problems. I think the more interesting approach, and this is what I would have called a disruptive approach. And by the way, so let's you know, I would love to make this as a checklist. So number one, capital deployed, Tesla. So column one is Tesla. Column mm-hmm. two is the alternative. So column one, Tesla, capital deployed, line one, billions of dollars. Alternative, millions of dollars. Okay. Let's go down the list.
Yeah, he has Wall Street on his side these days too, certainly.
Yeah, target market. Yeah. Rich people, Tesla.
Yes.
Poor people, column B, okay. Third point, small size of vehicle. Huge, or I would say even before it was small, but it was essentially, it was a toy. It was not meant to be utility-driven.
Yeah, it was a marketing exercise. Sure.
It's utility and prestige. We can even call that as the next object on the next thing, the job to be done. The job to be done of Tesla from day one has been to make rich people feel good about the fact that they destroyed the world. And so you go down that list, foothold market, the U.S. And you go down the list and you think, what is the exact opposite of what Tesla did? And you put that in column B, and you would that there you, by going down that list, you will actually create the disruptive idea.
So let me pop the balloon. So why didn't Tata's Nano or the Renault Logan, why have those things not taken off? I mean, is it lack of infrastructure? Is it?
I actually think that they haven't been thought through in a system-wide fashion. And here's what I mean. This is probably, I know Clay is actually, he has relationship with Tata Group. At one point he was on the board of Tata Consulting. So I don't know, I haven't asked him, but I assume he has given some input on the Nano. But the problem is that, again, it's product-oriented. It's not the entire process, or I even say beyond the process. To rethink automobiles, you have to rethink all these things on my long list. Where does it take a foothold? Now, one thing is it is in India, but the company building them is an incumbent in India that has already one of the largest market shares of automobile manufacturing in India. So if you look at percent of cars produced in India, I think the Tata Group makes, if it's not number one, it's certainly in the top three. The next problem is that they repurposed not just their business model. They repurposed their plants, their designers, their engineers, their production people. They built a new plant for the Nano, but it was on a blueprint of all the other plants in anywhere in the world. You have to rethink at the very, very bottom the idea of what manufacturing actually is. There's one example I've seen of rethinking of the manufacturing process, and that's BMW's
iCity or something.
iWorks, I don't know what they're calling it. Yeah. But there's
of course, their price points are not exactly your emerging markets either.
Right, but that's because you got to go down this checklist.
Yeah, yeah.
They're launching by building factories in Germany to make cars for Germans.
Right.
Now, if you're going to do this right, again, my idea would be, yes, the India part was the right thing to do, but the wrong thing was doing it using a large integrated plant. The better thing to do is build a cottage industry where people make parts for cars and then they get assembled in an almost a do-it-yourself fashion. That is as low as possible. Not even the BMW vision changes dramatically the whole idea. So here's my dream of a new car metaphor. Because again, like we've seen this in computing. Computing went personal, and computing went from something that only IBM complicated and expensive way could make computers, down to a hobbyist who could do it themselves. And that happened actually very, very early on in the 70s and 80s. Hobbyists could make computers because of microprocessors. And so the thing modularized once the microprocessor became available. And so we haven't seen anything like that in the auto industry. Of course, you have people putting cars together on their own, but they're discouraged from selling those cars because the regulations say you cannot be a car manufacturer without getting the car certified and all these other things, but also the safety requirements and all these other things preclude someone from being a do-it-yourself car maker. And so this is where an emerging economy is exciting, because the components have been modularized to the point where you can buy them off the shelf. The body panels, here's the other thing, is when you look at the way a hobbyist would build a car, they would, as a kit car, they would start with a frame. Usually it's either frame on body on frame, or it's a tubular exoskeleton type thing. I don't know exactly terms for it, but the way cars are made in mass production, they're done as a unibody, stamped sheet metal, welded by robots, painted, and so on and so on. So the process of building cars is done the same way everywhere in the world when you're dealing with mass production. And then the hobbyist model, which is like putting it together from a kit, you might weld a few things together, but it's not going to be done in, you do it one off. Now, what I'm struggling with, and I think this is an exciting thing, is that what if you could create a hybrid between these two, where you could manufacture do-it-yourself cars on a large scale, where the components don't need a steel stamping press, which is, stamping machines are sometimes the size of buildings. They are probably the most expensive part of the factory. One data point, just to give you an idea, I was reading an article about a new plant that was being built in Japan for Toyota, a new Toyota plant. There haven't been very many in Japan, by the way, for quite a long time.
No, they're leaving mostly.
Yeah, there was a big deal that Toyota built a plant in Japan, and they did it as cheaply as possible. And they said they were trying to move it also to the U.S. and build a U.S. plant along the same lines. And an exec at Toyota said that 60, or is it 60 or 40? Gosh, I don't remember exactly. But a significant amount of the cost of a car is paying back for the manufacturing plant.
Sure.
So the multi-billion, yeah. A multi-billion dollar plant requires you to sort of mortgage your production to it for a long, long time. So a car, for example, that costs 15, 20, let's see, I don't know, cars don't cost 15,000 anymore, do they?
25,000,
you know, like maybe, 10,000 of that is actually paying back the mortgage on the plant.
Yeah, it's like an Intel fab, right? Billions for the fab.
Exactly. So when you get into these cost structures, you have to ask, could there be a better way? Can you squeeze that down so that it doesn't cost billions, it costs millions? And this is what Tesla said. Probably they didn't even ask the question. They didn't ask. He said, oh, we want to make cars, so let's call does anybody know somebody who knows how to make cars? So you pick up the phone, you find, because you've got money, you've got all the resources in the world.
Well capitalized, of course, yes.
But yeah, you go and get the best guys, and the best guys are going to tell you, yes, you need $1 billion to make a plant, and they bought the one in Fremont.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, you know, they're a car manufacturer and all the pomp and ceremony that goes with that. Instead of sort of saying, well, you know what, we don't have any money, we don't have any smart people that know how to make cars, let's figure it out how to do it without that. And by the way, the Chinese and the Koreans and everybody who, even the Indians who got into this business, they all did the same thing, because the government said, yes, I think we should have a car industry. And so they brought on board the smartest, brightest people and said, okay, you have the franchise, go forth and make a car industry for us. And then, you know, they pick up the phone, find out the best manufacturing experts, and, you know, let's start building car plants, and they'll use the same blueprints as they did everywhere else. Canada, doesn't matter, Iran.
Well, it's every about jobs, it's not about the cars at that point for the governments. They want the
exactly,
jobs and the tax
exactly.
base.
So yeah. No one stopped to say, wait a minute, is there another way to build cars? No, there's one way to build cars, and that's what all of us use it. And you can prove it because it's so commonly done, and there's no dissenting voices to this subject. And that's that to me is the frustration, is that It is very definitely possible. We have existence proofs all over the place, especially in the technology industry, that you can make stuff differently. And why should cars be exempt from this rule? Now, one thing that may happen that could be really exciting is this, you know, if we have manufacturing technologies desktop printing,
3D printing, and all
yeah,
that.
They call it, yeah, 3D printing. 3D printing of certain parts might change dramatically. You know, we need to get into larger stuff that needs to be made. But if you can use steel tubing for your frame, if you could use composite materials for your body panels, if you could use off the shelf either electric or gas or diesel, doesn't matter. The powertrain is like picking a CPU. For your computer.
That could be purchased, no doubt.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there are plenty of companies that make them as modules. So the only problem is, how do you do the final assembly? How do you deal with issues of painting? How do you deal with issues of regulatory approvals? And so on and so on. And so, by the way, so I mentioned also this Gordon Murray guy who has put forth some ideas. There's not much to read, so I don't know how far he's on this trajectory, but he also has the right idea that says, really, you have to, I think he calls it iStream. The whole idea is to think from the very beginning. And because, and it makes sense, because he came out of car racing. And in car racing, they have essentially a custom building process where although you can make a run of cars, each one is hand-built. And it's built from a design that is very light, that is very modular, and it is optimized not for throughput of production but for performance. And if you borrow the best ideas from racing and then apply a little bit of mass production magic to it, I think that process could be a very exciting idea. The problem is, he's going to run into a problem trying to sell this idea to existing manufacturers who have committed to workflows, to have committed to cost structures, and to have committed to markets that steer them away from it. And that's the whole problem, is to break this knot, barrier. It's you need to kind of take the idea outside of the context, which I think is into developing markets, to try to create indigenous production, to do something in along those lines. And it'll take a long time, and it won't seem like there's much progress. But anyway, that's the cool stuff.
So why have some of these niche assemblers not you think, expanded? I mean, you have one in Finland. Is it Valmet?
Well, it's a contract manufacturing. That's another thing. Right. Very, very rare to have contract manufacturing in cars. Why? Contract manufacturing, meaning that, okay, you pick up the phone, you have a design. Maybe you made the design yourself, or you hired someone to make your design, as happens in computers. In computers, HP doesn't do anything. HP picks up the phone and says, I need a computer for next year or the year after that. And somebody in Taiwan presents them with a design. And then they say, okay, I'll take that design. Now please arrange manufacturing. And somebody picks up the phone again and calls the contract manufacturers. So you have contract designers, contract manufacturers, and then somebody else does probably contract support and sales. And so the company in the center, HP or Acer or any of the brands we see on a computer, don't ever touch the product.
Right.
They're not involved. I think it was one of them was famous about actually being proud of the fact that they don't touch the product anyway along this any stage of its value, of its existence. All they do is they are essentially a project manager. So they manage the project and the brand. And same is now happening in TVs. Vizio, for example, I think it's called, or something like that. One of the biggest brands in TV today has nothing to do with TVs. They don't make them, they don't design them, they don't ship them, they don't service them, they don't sell them. There are a couple of hundred people in an office in San Diego. That is the brand. Right. So
the Boxster and the Cayman, for example, are assembled in some of them.
Yes.
In Finland.
So what happened is that you have a few of these plants. So they're like the Foxconn, but
right.
tiny. The number of units that get produced this way globally for the car industry must be like in the tens of thousands.
Right,
it may
small.
Be more common for trucks and buses, but I don't know that industry well. If you focus on passenger vehicles, cars in particular, it's unheard of. You've got these tiny, sometimes, like if you have a product, in the case of the Cayman or the Porsche Boxster, These were not fitting into Porsche's existing plants. The existing plants were set up for the 911 or the Cayenne or something like that, and those were running at full speed. So for them to slot in a limited production or limited run of the product extension, it made sense for them to actually outsource it. But this outsourced company or contract manufacturer is really batch oriented. They're not continuous flow type of business, so they're not going to generate large volumes. In many ways, actually, so is Foxconn. That's how they operate, more in the batch model.
Right, right. They have massive demand, and then it goes away, and massive demand. Yeah,
yeah.
But you would think that these guys that make the niche cars would have, some experience in the contract or the supplier relationships to think differently about this. I'm just surprised it hasn't happened, actually.
You're right. And so that's possibly where the route could, the disruptive route could disruption could take root. And how it would happen, some contract manufacturer says, I've been doing this for other people. I'm at their mercy. In fact, this plant in Finland, they had Porsche for a while, right? They had even Saab a couple of years ago. They did a couple of Saabs. Then they got a deal with Fiskar. And then that whole thing imploded, and they had to lay off their workforce. They basically, their pipeline ran dry, and so they couldn't keep the plant open even. And they would probably, they should be scratching their heads and saying, well, why don't we create our own company? Our own brand. And then they probably, someone smart will tell them, what you have to get through? You'll have to get through regulatory issues. You have to find a way to market this. You don't have the competency to do any of these things. And they would just, say, yep, looks like Mission Impossible. But if you were naive enough, and you were in an emerging country in which you were doing this contract work, and then you realize that there might be a local demand for something that you built yourself. Maybe it's a tractor. Maybe it's not even a car. Maybe it's a motorcycle, or it's a moped or something like that. A lot of that is going on in China now. But these guys who used to do it for somebody else, decide that, hey, we can actually build a brand. We can actually build engineering. We can actually find people to buy it. So this happens so many times in so many different industries. It's a little bit boring to even go back into it, but that's what's not happening in the car industry. And you're pointing out exactly why it's one of these things where you have to go do a more analysis. My instinct says that there hasn't been indigenous production because people are fearful. They think it's too expensive. They think that they need an integrated approach. They don't. Even if you ask someone in an emerging country, why don't you build a car company? They will say, yeah, but even the people in this country, they respect BMW. They respect Western brands. So if I introduce a local brand, they're not going to buy it from me, even though it's made here and it's cheaper and so on, because they've been brainwashed to think that only foreign cars are good. You know what I mean? So,
of course.
So there's overcoming that. But there's also counterexamples to that. Take the VW Beetle. The VW Beetle was the anti-GM in a sense, because it was when you look at their advertising, they celebrated the fact that they were quirky. They Sure. celebrated the fact that they were weird and they were an outsider and they didn't conform to any of the notions at the time of being competitive. And they were great as a counterculture symbol and as a disruptive idea in the 1960s that a small car made sense in a big car country. And so to every list of impossible goals and impossible things to overcome, you have these examples of in history where it did happen, and so you have to have faith. At the end of the day, all the great bets are based on faith. The data will tell you always not to do this. So anyway, I don't know.
You know, one of the things we talked about a few months ago was the automakers missing the shift. You know, the position for the iPhone or apps, and thinking that the car is the center point of the apps versus the smartphone or tablet, let's say. You know, is it possible that the value will change, the perception people will have will change, and car sharing or
that's where
the apps, you know, the somebody will, almost like iTunes on Windows, somebody will create a value model on top of the current industry and therefore make the industry
another,
more generic. I mean, and maybe that's more like
that is the, indeed probably the most exciting way, because an outsider will come in, look at the problem as an information problem, not a transportation problem. They'll look at it and say, this would be my dream. Someone would say, you know, I see the job to be done here. The job is people don't want cars. Ownership of cars is not just expensive, but it's actually adding a lot of waiting into your life. Waiting in traffic,
yes.
Waiting to park, waiting in line at the DMV, whatever. You've got all of these hassles associated with cars, so we're going to solve your problem of transportation by providing you with less waiting. And then they say, well, that's an information problem, because you're knowing where the cars are and so on, and allocating the car. So the car at that moment is off the shelf, and you say, okay, we'll just pick whatever cars are available. Oh, if it's electric, it's even better, because our economics are going to be better with electric cars.
Right,
they won't break as much, and so on. So the innovator in this case looks at it as an information problem, attacks a job to be done that's unmet, uses off-the-shelf technology, which is just a city car with
sure.
electric drive, and then says, you know what, these cars, I go back to the manufacturer and I tell them, you know, what would make them better is if we had this or that or the other thing. And then the manufacturer would say, well, thanks, we'll get back to you in 5 years. And you don't have that time. And you say, no, I want to have it done next 6 months. Then you start to think, you know what, maybe I can make the car myself. That is really the spark of a potential story there, because if the person, and that's the cool thing, it's the same thing that happened with smartphones, where you know, Apple said, you know, in order for us to get a better phone, we need to solve these problems, and that may involve getting into new businesses, right? So
you
get into apps, you get into services, you get into Siri, you get into, suddenly you're solving whole set of different problems.
Owning
but
and leasing capital equipment.
Yeah, and but the fuel was the huge profit you got because you solved the job.
Yeah.
The fuel to get you into the new industries is supplied in ample quantities beyond what you can absorb. And so suddenly this guy who's making a business selling information really to consumers about where to get a car at a time when they need it and not to get a car when they don't need it. That is simple shift makes them hopefully, you know, wealthy beyond their wildest dreams. And they say, you know what, I have so much capital now, actually I can buy a car company. And they're actually quite cheap to buy because, as you know, they don't make much money. And so they're usually wasting assets.
Right.
So you go in and they could go and grab, you know, Saab, for example. Boom. Just pick up Saab for peanuts, right? Or pick up a brand out of the UK or something, as the Indians
right.
did. They bought Jaguar, they bought
right.
Land Rover. You know, BMW bought Mini, which was essentially a defunct brand in the UK as well. So you can get that, and you get the brand, and you can get some tooling, some facilities, some distribution network, whatever. Throw most of it away and rebuild the business along the lines that serve this need. And so they would then create a niche for themselves in sort of electric vehicles, optimized around the job to be done of not being owned. And then they have great connectivity, that they have built-in mesh networking, that they're actually built around the information problem. So they have perfect metering. They have better metering than taxis do, right? They're down. They're getting the
well,
resolution.
That's already happening. I mean, OnStar and others are selling their data, you know, to insurance companies. There's deals back and forth over,
exactly.
you know, risk management. So for this revolution to happen, for this disruption to happen, do self-driving cars have to become available first, given the regulatory issues, or is there enough?
Self-driving is one of these things that I think is a little bit cramming, as they say. It's a technology that's being crammed into the at a too early a stage on the evolution of what can be absorbed. The problem obviously is because it's not only does it have social impact, not only does it have all kinds of liability issues, all kinds of incredible. Incredible problems in terms of fitting in to the existing value networks, but fundamentally, I think it may be simply too early. The technology itself is not the problem. Is that it's like the best example might be where here you have great computing power and great technology, and so it's sitting on the shelf and saying, let's apply it to the problems of cars by making cars drive themselves. Now, I'm going to take you back, and this is one of the great stories from Christensen, which is the story of the transistor. And the story of the transistor is that when it was developed, it was the idea of solid-state amplifying solid-state gates that were driving the main application of that, the problem that the transistor solved was amplification, and that was really radio and later TV. And so when the transistor was invented, the guys who were making radios and TVs looked at it and they said, we can't really make use of it because the quality of amplification is far worse than the tubes that we're using. And so, but we're not ignoring it. So they took it under R&D development, and they began to develop better quality transistors, and they spent billions on semiconductor research and solid state, but not bringing anything to market. In the meantime, the transistor was taken by hearing aid companies, by the Japanese with transistor radios, which are very poor quality radios, which didn't have a lot of amplification because you had a single earpiece to listen through. There wasn't a need for filling a room with sound, which is what the radio market at the time was all about, the console radio and the console TVs, which sat in the living room. And so what happened is that the disruptive approach came via a completely different track, not through the existing industry. So my point is that replace transistor with computing technology, right, with algorithms, with all of the cloud and all the stuff that Google works on, and you say, all right, so Google is taking that transistor and trying to apply it to the car today, and they're going to be in development for decades trying to make it work. In the meantime, somebody takes the information technology and says, we're going to make the equivalent of a hearing aid or a transistor radio, not to make cars drive themselves, but rather we're going to solve, hey, how about just cars being available when I need them, right? I'll drive them, but please tell me when and where I can go get a car, and I'm willing to pay for not owning it, right? That's the solving of the problem. And then those people who took that trajectory outside of the existing value network and the existing definition of what a car is, and then they might actually solve the self-driving problem, but because they'll take it in incremental steps. So one of the things obviously a smart car would have is a self-awareness in terms of where it is and so on. Maybe it sends you messages. Maybe it begins to communicate with you in ways and help you get the job done. And maybe in some cases it'll simply be inside of a parking facility and it'll just drive itself from its parking spot to sort of become a valet car. I mean, imagine instead of having self-driving cars, how about a self-valet car? There's an interesting problem, right? So you drop off the car at the front of the building and it drives itself into a parking spot. It's not solving it's not building a railroad across the continent. It is simply getting a small job done, and it's likely to learn from that to become better and better at doing it. And by the time it evolves into being a self-driving vehicle, they will have solved all the right problems, and they will have ignored all the impossible ones. That's where I'm thinking. That's how it should go.
There is another trouble with Google. Analogy to this somewhat. Was it maybe 10 years ago? There were several startups trying to create tiny point-to-point air routes. One of my friends was involved in one. Where they had this whole idea of these small jets, small planes that would take you from
air taxis. Yeah, yep.
The whole thing, right? There was a guy, I think from Citrix, I can't remember where, and he was put a lot of money into it, and of course he saw it as a big math problem, which it is in some ways, but just the economics just never worked. And
The downdraft in the market, in the whole economy, because a lot of the customers would be somewhat more wealthy. I remember because Clay was talking about this also a few years ago, the air taxi business, right, and suggesting that might be the disruption to the airline industry, because it was about making planes, taking the whole job to be done to a new level. The problem still is that it relies on too many dependencies, one of which was actually there have to be new types of airplanes, that there have to be wealthy enough customers, that it does work in the United States first and maybe not so easy to move to Europe, and it's got a lot of constraints on it. And there's one or two little things that may have killed it, that it was too fragile as an idea, although it had a lot of promise. And I'm not saying that this idea of an information-based car is going to work out. I'm just suggesting that a lot of the experiments I'm seeing today have less of a chance even than these rather fragile ideas that we're putting forward here, because these new fragile ideas are at least have a disruptive potential. Going against an entrenched system with a cramming and brute forcing a solution into that, it's the Segway, it's Google Glass, it's all of these things which are ambitious but rubbish, at the same time, to reuse a phrase from Jeremy Clarkson, and they're rubbish because they don't work as well as the average person, or even beyond a certain very tiny niche. They're not going to be useful. So, that's my rant. I the cars, we take it in so many directions. I think the job to be done, one of the things, there are opportunities. I think we did a bit of an email exchange on this, on what would you look for in a new car?
Yes.
And my answer to you, if you remember, was that that I liked the idea of making cars more to appeal to women, in particular if cars are
which was a factor in my purchase, by the way.
Yeah, but yeah, if and the phrase I picked up was a happy wife, a happy life. Life, right. It is one of these things that shocks me to this end, because it somehow women aren't part of the discussion. I mean, they are more and more, but the car makers haven't really nailed that that question of
Definitely not.
what is it that I know there are many women who work in car design. Actually, I met one once, but I think maybe what they've been working on in sort of feminizing the industry a bit is exactly this, that we are seeing a little bit of that. I think the mini brand, I mentioned it before, we have a mini now. The mini brand is absolutely the brightest idea in following this model, mainly because when you look at and I don't know if there's a lot of mini fans out there, and I'm not saying that there's anything feminine about it, but it does break through to women, and that's and you can see it in the colors, you can see it in the way it's essentially, it's accessorizable,
right? That was their key I think strategy, was this almost limitless accessorization of the car, colors, yeah. All these things.
If you look through a brochure, it's like half of it is taken up by changing this or that little thing about it. Mostly it's all aesthetics and, yes. Having little labels. It has one on the car seat instead of having, some kind of writing on it or something like that. But it has a little clothing tag, the little thing that comes off. It says airbag on it. So it's got that tactile feeling. It feels like an item of clothing. I won't get into it. I'm not trying to sell minis here. But the thing is that what I appreciated was that they understood that the job to be done is that you want to have a distinctive looking car that you can accessorize, that it also it shows off your sense of style. It shows off your sense of taste. And that is indeed the job that many women hire clothes for. They hire the clothes and their wardrobe and their shoes to show that they are competent in choosing clothes, that they can put an outfit together, and that it's not just looking good and feeling good, but it's a signaling method that look, I am
thinking I'm competent, put it together,
I'm competent in this regard, and you should respect me for it. And that's, men will do the same with all kinds of things. Obviously, it's not just a female-only job, but I'm saying that along the dimension of putting something together like that, and if you watch girls when they play, they also like to put things together, right? And make an ensemble. That is one of the jobs, and that's only, as far as I know, only Mini solves it at this point. And so, obviously, they become extremely attracted to it. And I don't know what the numbers are, but I would be willing to bet. And if you drive a Mini, you start to notice a lot of other Minis, just like in the Volkswagen, you start to notice Volkswagens. But if you drive a Mini, and then we do see a lot of Minis, and you look at the driver, I would say it's 80% female. That's my impression. I could be wrong. And they'll make a model that will be masculine if you want it. Obviously, the color changes and all these other things, and then you can make a powerful version and all the other stuff. But that's probably a small group relative to the ones who are really focused on just having a wonderful looking car. So anyway, that's one aspect of how you can take the car industry as it is, but simply evolve the job to be done in a slightly new direction. And you're dealing with 50% of the market in enabling that. And by the way, I'm sure Minis are often also second cars in the family, so there would be a compromise for the man, because he would have also maybe his car. But so anyway, that's just one thought I had about how you can solve the job to be done. And I think what you're seeing more and more with cars is positioning on jobs, trying, or at least the clever ones are figuring out the jobs and not saying our car is a crossover for this or that demographic. They've created over time, they've created car categories. So if you ask any car worldwide, what's your portfolio? What car? Well, they'll talk about it as they all speak the same language. Well, it's a compact segment car, as if that was somehow somehow a universal language that everybody understands, that every consumer thinks, I'm going to go buy myself a compact segment. Right. or
crossover SUV, right?
A crossover SUV. No, so they all build. So you see the copycats going on, you know. So you have somebody builds, oh, we don't have a minivan. Oh, we got to have a minivan now because somebody else had. And then somebody builds an SUV. Oh, you have to have an SUV. Right. So they establish a category. It's not that there's a job. There might be a proxy for a job. But eventually, they all begin to say you have to have that category in your portfolio, otherwise you're. So what used to be, and these categories are out of control. I mean, look at BMW. Okay, BMW suddenly, you know,
car for every niche. Yes.
They're all over the place, yes. And they have to have an SUV, not only one but several. They have to have a crossover. They have to have Porsche has to have one too. Yes. They have to have a tiny little city car. They have to have bought the Mini for some things, right. But they also have the 1 Series. Then they have to have a 2-door. They have to have 4-door. On and on it goes. And then Mercedes did the same. And so the Germans are like in lockstep following the same formulas. And whether you're French or German, I'm sure, I don't know much about French cars, but you pretty much see the same thing. And so they've all lost any Frenchness of them, you know, or German, because it used to be that German meant something, and it meant performance, it meant luxury, but it meant mostly engineering. And now
it's
now brand, and they're all they have the same bunch of cars, right. Same sizes, the same cookie cutter as everyone else, and they're all built using the same process.
Absolutely.
And what's more, if you start to look, and I don't have proof of this, but if you start to look at the factories, you see the same tools are in use by every single car factory in the world. And because the same tools are in use, it's the same process, it's the same cost structure, it's the same quality. So you can't differentiate anymore. So if you want robots, you got robots. The same robot company will sell you robots for any car plant in the world. Same sheet stamping, same paint process. It's all certified. You know, so it doesn't pollute. So you have to have the latest design. It's, you know, all the governments got together and they all agreed that, you know, it has to be a water-based process. Da da da. Da. So you have this multiple hundreds of feet long process for painting cars, and the same supplier supplies probably, or there's probably two suppliers in the world that can deliver that type of paint shop. So, and so the paint shop is like put in every factory in the world, and right. That's why they all look the same, they all feel the same.
So let's sort of wrap up by just taking the inverse view, again, with the growing urbanization, the growing use of public transit by young people. In the States, you know, we have this thing, maybe you've seen it, Megabus. They $25, I think you go from Chicago to Minneapolis, you can ride it, you know, in New England, there's a lot of them, but they're big double-decker buses that have Wi-Fi.
I think first took off in the New York-Boston route.
So they've grown. So, you know, if you think about the job to be done, I have my smartphone, I have my tablet, I'm going to consume, I'm going to create things, whatever I'm going to do, and so that is more important to me than sitting behind the wheel and dealing with traffic. In these urban connections, let's say.
Yeah, public transportation could be another thing. This is also has kind of run into a wall. Public transportation in most of the world is quite good. We have a lot of options, you know, in Europe, for example. In the U.S., it's stagnated and atrophied, and in fact often regressed, much to, you know, a lot of political debate around that. Unfortunately, it's missing the point. A lot of it is about the economics of ridership and so on, but at the end of the day, you have to ask the job to be done, and because of the way the infrastructure is laid out, the job cannot be done by public transport. But again, there's an opportunity for someone to figure something out where you go to a hybrid model, where you figure out a new thing like communication infrastructure. If you make that available, people will commute more because they'll say, I can be productive during that hour.
Exactly.
On the train, bus.
Exactly.
And I have a thing where I could take my son to school driving, or I could take my son to school in a bus. And the bus, though, takes about I would say, twice as long, maybe a bit longer. So I would lose a day, an hour a day, probably, if I took the bus. But it's more comfortable in some ways because I don't stress over the driving. I don't stress, especially when the weather's bad. But I feel like I'm wasting my time there. Never, you know. So on in balance, I still would take the driving option. But if a couple of things were tipped against driving, for example, congestion charge in the city,
right,
that would drive my cost through the roof. Second, would be if they added Wi-Fi onto the buses sufficiently and provided, although there's 3G, but there are some issues with using a computer on the bus. But if they architected it in such a way, right, gave you a little bit more room, gave you a little bit more, maybe a power socket or something like that, suddenly people will rethink public transportation, and they'll think of it as productive time. And that's where one wonders, why aren't they doing this? So the job, focus on the job, do the proper research, survey people, don't ask them how much does it cost. Money's never usually the only thing that people care about, and maybe the only thing you can measure, because it's something easily surveyed and you can easily capture data on that. But the real problem is usually deeper, and the calculus that takes place in the person's mind is complicated. The decision process, do I do it or do I not do it? You have to sit down with somebody, work through that in a long interview process with an inquisitive type of mind. That gets you to the answer, and then do it a few hundred times to get a good sample. Then you paint the right picture, and not much gets done that way. So anyway.
I think we've covered a lot here, Horace, and probably have we need to talk about bikes as well. I have a few things on that, maybe.
Oh yeah,
but I'm going to stop.
Bikes, cars, buses, trucks—all these things—they all depend on roads. And what few people talk about is how are roads built? How are roads funded? How are roads designed? And that all these things—the design of infrastructure. Cannot happen independent of the vehicle, and that's, or the vehicle cannot be rebuilt and redesigned without understanding the infrastructure. And this is why the world you think of it as already modular, and we think cars are plug compatible with roads, but they're so plug compatible that no other car fits in, right? And then we realize that, hang on, then that means we can't put bikes on the road because we don't have places for them. We haven't built roads to accommodate bikes, and when we try, we get into all kinds of problems, and the bike lane issues and all that stuff. Yeah, so you're right. We should talk about this the next time.
Yes.